This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Elise Rosenhaupt. She's author of the new book, Climbing Back, A Family's Journey Through Brain Injury. She will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore next week, Wednesday, September 9th at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. This is such an interesting book because it's a memoir not only about a real trauma suffered by your son, Martin, who at the age of 20 was hit by a car, landed on his head, spent quite a bit of time in intensive care and then in rehabilitation, and this whole memoir of this injury. But it's not only a trauma to him, but to you and to your husband and to your whole family and to a whole circle of people who all are very deeply affected by this event and its aftermath. Why did you decide to write this now? This is nearly, what is it, almost 20 years later?
It's close to 20 years later. In one sense, I didn't decide to write it now. I started making notes when we were in the hospital, initially just trying to remember who was who and what the doctor's name was and what kind of a doctor that doctor was. And then I started writing little, I'd say, philosophical scribblings or just musings while there was a great deal of quiet sitting, he was unconscious time. And eventually I'd written something that was quite a bit longer, and I showed it to someone and mentioned that my father, too, had suffered traumatic brain injury. And that reader said, well, why did you not bring that in? And it's insane. You have these other stories that seem to pertain. And so I wrote more and more and more. And essentially, I've been writing it for a very long time and discovering in the process that things that happened in the past and things that happened after this terrible accident all had some kind of connection or correspondence to the story of the accident and the rehabilitation.
I have to say that while reading it, I thought, boy, there's a lot of people falling on their heads in your family.
You would think that, and that's probably true. And yet the other thing that I find is when I chat with people about this or that and mention that I've written a book, an amazing number of people say, you know, something happened to me, or I have a cousin who, the young man who cut my hair recently said he had a nephew who had suffered from a drug overdose and was interested in the theories of recovery. And so more and more I find that pretty much everyone you talk with says, something has happened to me, and it may not be directly a brain injury, but there's a sense of this, there's a common thread that people tap into.
I think one of the interesting things that comes out of very rough situations like the one you were in is that you get to know yourself and others better in ways that are sometimes surprising. And one of the things that I found surprising was that, I mean, both you and your husband, very well-educated people, Harvard and Radcliffe, highly educated and intelligent, found, and you in particular, found yourself very passive with respect to the doctors and wished in retrospect that you hadn't been quite so passive.
Yes, and I think the truth is, In reflection, we were very passive for a period, and we were probably in shock. And yet, in actuality, we started, partly through help that was given to us through some very fortunate connections, we started about 3 days after arriving at the hospital taking a more proactive role. Particularly, my husband realized that the doctors were always coming around at about 6 in the morning, and since he wanted to talk to them, he needed to be there by 5:45, because asking them to talk with him through a message was not going to work, but being physically in front of them did work.
There are a lot of manifestations, and I mean, every brain injury is different, but there are some things that many of them have in common, and one of them is that when people are starting to recover from a brain injury, they swear a lot.
They swear a lot, they're agitated, there's mania, and fortunately, before Martin encountered that period, or before we encountered it, I had been warned by a friend who knew someone who had been through this and who was very close to it. And so when it began to happen, I was not alarmed, I wasn't thrilled, but I had been told this is perfectly normal, and fortunately the nurses who did talk to us, unlike the doctors, were there saying this is absolutely to be expected, don't be alarmed.
One of the things that must be hardest about it, and you really are able to write about this very thoughtfully in the memoir, is the profound not knowing. I mean, you arrive, it so happened, you were living in New Mexico, but it so happened that you were in New York visiting your daughter in New York when this happened to your son in Massachusetts, and you immediately drove up to Boston and were there and were just the best parents that anybody could be, and you had, thank goodness, flexibility, enough flexibility with your work that you could really stay there and care for him and be there and so on. But when your child, your vulnerable 20-year-old child, lying there unconscious, is in this state, you have no idea if he's going to wake up, how he's going to wake up, what kind of a future he has, and there's no way to know that. And navigating that must be one of the hardest things.
It was hard, and yet I think at some level an impulse kicked in that at some point I call the be here now impulse, where you simply know that there's nothing that you can do, and you simply accept that and find a way to do what you need to do and to be there quietly waiting. And what you need to do is simply to be there, to touch him, to be ready to pay attention when there's new information coming down the pike, to ask questions, but there's no point saying why did this happen, or what could have been done differently, or what's going to happen next, because there's so much unknown, and the only way to live with the unknown is simply to accept it and to be there.
It is striking how many things went in your favor and in your son Martin's favor when all this was concerned. So, for example, the accident happened late at night, and it was really clearly nobody's fault, except Martin did say later, if only I'd been a better son and looked both ways, as Mom had taught me. But, you know, it wasn't the driver's fault. The EMTs came and took him to the very best possible hospital. You had the resources, you had the friends, the insurance worked well, and the support from his college was there. There were so many things that, I mean, one can imagine a parallel memoir of a similar experience where one or two or three or five of those things weren't in place that would have made the situation much harder and probably have a different outcome.
That's true. And someone actually wrote to me, a friend who had written the book, and said, how do you deal with the fact that you had so many advantages, that that you were well-educated and so on and so forth? And then he ended his letter saying, well, I guess you just have to work with what you're given. And all I can say is that we at least recognized that we had been given a great deal. And part of what I spent a fair amount of time thinking about and talking about was how unfair it was that other people didn't have the advantages. It wasn't unfair that we had good treatment and other advantages, but it did seem not right that others might not have that sort of an advantage. And I might say parenthetically, that's one of the things that has probably been behind the fact that my husband and I have both been on the picket line. It wasn't quite a picket line, but on the line supporting the nurses when they recently had a dispute with the hospital in town, because to us it was very obvious that the nurses needed support, and that you have to, if you've been given advantages, you need to give back to the people, especially the people that you see as the heroes.
Yeah, nurses come off very much as the heroes in your book.
Yes.
Tell us about your experience with the nurses, both in the ICU, where Martin was for a while, and then in the rehabilitation hospital.
Well, in the ICU, it was interesting because at the start, one nurse has one patient. And the nurses were incredibly competent, incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly fast. And so our son had just a full-time attendant who, at some point, we speculated that there was clearly a class and gender divide at Mass General. And we picked up that one of the nurses in particular would have been a neurosurgeon had she been born a boy, and had she perhaps gone to a better school, come from a family with a little bit more financial backing to it. And so those people were just phenomenal, and they also were very good to us, partly because we recognized their level of competence and knew that we needed to anticipate every move that they made and stay out of their way when they were working. So it was almost like a beautifully choreographed dance in which they would be dancing around Martin and we would be dancing out of their way before they got to the next place they needed to be. Similarly, when we got to New England Rehabilitation Hospital, which was a very wonderful place that we chose after looking at three other places, each of which had benefits but was clearly not the place that Martin needed to be, the nurses there were wonderful in a different way. The very first nurse suggested that patients do much better when they're wearing their own clothes. And Martin had been transported in an ambulance wearing the hospital gown that is provided by Mass General. And the first thing we did was, as soon as he fell asleep that night, go out to a mall and buy him soft clothing that was easy to get off and on over his head and easy to pull on. And he was able to wear his own clothes and feel much more like himself. And other nurses and even nursing aides did remarkable things for him, including one whom I will always remember, who suggested that perhaps the rash on his skin was due to the bleach in the sheets, and she put in an order for unbleached sheets. And it was another difference in that rehab hospital was that there was the sense that the nurses and the aides were not in any way intimidated by people with higher rank, and perhaps even the word rank didn't apply at New England Rehab. In Mass General, a nurse would be taking her life in her hands, and usually the nurse was a woman, although not always, to suggest to a doctor something needed to be done. And at New England Rehab, the aides had no fear of making a suggestion for the patient's well-being.
I thought that was such an interesting sub-theme of the book, the one hospital being so hierarchical and the other being so much more based on a kind of model of equality. And as you talk about nurses, they know so much that they're not given credit for, and they are the ones who interpret what they know to you, the patient and the patient's family.
And I think in a good hospital, they are also the ones who interpret to the doctors and tell the doctors right. that there has been this problem or this thing that looks better than the doctor was perhaps expecting. Because the doctor only sees the patient for 5 minutes, perhaps twice a day, and that would be a lot of time. And particularly at Mass General, the nurse saw Martin for 12 hours every single day, with perhaps an occasional run to the bathroom, but that would be about the only time that the nurse was not right there with him.
Amazing. We're talking to Elise Rosenhaupt about her memoir, Climbing Back, A Family's Journey Through Brain Injury. And one thing that I really want to talk to you about is Martin himself, who was really a very special young person. And you can see this in the memoir. And it's not only, I think, a mother's love that's driving this portrayal of him, although that's has to be a little part of it, but the determination and the equanimity with which he dealt with what had happened to him is really very special. I mean, he came out of it, and thank goodness the kind of brain injury he had apparently didn't change his personality, and that was a great stroke of luck, or randomness, whatever you want to call it.
It was a great stroke of something wonderful.
Yeah, it was a great stroke of something wonderful, and pretty much as soon as he could talk, he was speaking and thinking clearly. He started making jokes pretty quickly. And he really, on some level, took his healing into his own hands and made some real decisions about moving forward, and did so with remarkable speed.
He did, and I think there are many factors that get credit for that. One certainly is his youth. He was young when the accident happened. He had always been, or always from a certain point, at least from when he began high school, he had had a good deal of self-discipline, which included the self-discipline to say, I'd like to go to such and such a party. I'm awfully tired. I have a test tomorrow. And when his sister would have chosen to go to that wonderful party, he would choose to go to bed early and miss the party. So that there was some self-discipline, there was temperament. And another factor that was an incredible boon was that he had become, in the year between high school and starting college, he had become an emergency medical technician. And some of his training had actually been about brain injuries. So he was able, from remembering what his blood pressure was from one day to the next, eventually when he was in the rehab hospital, and other details, to feel as if he was taking charge, which with brain injury, there are so many things that you're not in charge of. At first, you're not able to walk, and he had to relearn various basic things like how to shave, how to take a shower, which is far more complicated than you might think, because you've got to remember not to put that wonderful towel that you've brought with you in the shower. You've got to remember to keep it dry. And yet there was this one area where he was so far ahead of the curve in terms of medical understanding and knowledge. So all of those things helped him a great deal. But also because he was basically a patient person who had always moved at his own pace and never wanted to rush. And in fact, I think often probably been fairly frustrated by his mother, his father, and his sister, who all are inclined to move sometimes too fast.
This ends up being not only a memoir about traumatic brain injury, but really a memoir about your life, about your parents, about your extended family, about not only your son, but your daughter, and your son, not just in the context of brain injury, but what he was like as a small child, what he was like as a baby and a toddler, and being a prankster, and then kind of growing out of it into a remarkably mature child and then young man. And there's a kind of, it ends up being more than a recovery story. It ends up being kind of a life memoir.
It does. And I was actually surprised when I was working on the final format to find that the editor I worked with was using the word memoir, and I had actually not even thought of it as a memoir. and had thought of it much more as a story of recovery that involved various people in the family. And yet, you're right, it does very much take in a lot of things in different parts going back of my family, which may be partly because I'm an only child, and although both of my parents had siblings, they both came from Europe and did not have much family around them, and so I've always in a way been fascinated by how families work and imagining how my family might have worked had my parents had another child, which they were disappointed was not something that happened. And so in some ways, writing this was an opportunity for me to make a lot of the connections, or put down in writing a lot of the connections that had been tumbling around inside my head for a long time.
What is it like for your family, for your son in particular, to read this book? What effect has it had on your family?
Everyone in the family has been reluctant to read the book for a couple of reasons. One is I've been working on it so long, and it's been through so many forms that I simply can't blame them for being tired of reading it and saying, is this the last version? What have you put in? What's new? I've read this before, and I don't want to. But also, for all of them, it's painful. And I understand how painful it is, and there are parts that are still incredibly painful for me, although there's a kind of a dissociation when you read as an editor from what you experience as the person who went through something. My son, I have simply said, you absolutely do not have to read this. He doesn't really want to go back there, and I don't think he needs to go back there, because back there is completely gone. And he processed it by his recovery, and I probably processed it by going through his recovery and helping him, but also by writing it. He has been incredibly gracious to me in saying, if this is what you want to do, then you do it. And if you want to have a radio interview about it, then do that. That's fine. You can do whatever you like. And I'm incredibly grateful to him. He did not feel that way 10 years ago. And now he has just moved past it and is kind enough to be asking me what I need and supporting me in that.
Has writing the book and having it be done and going through these edits, and then, I mean, there's something about having a book in your hand and a front and back cover, and it's finished. Has that effected a kind of transformation about this series of traumatic events for you? Did it make a difference?
It probably did, because it made a difference in the experience, I think. More than anything, it probably made a difference in, now I'm no longer struggling with how am I going to get this written, and how many more changes am I going to make. At some point, I read what Anne Lamott had to say about the process of writing. Anne Lamott, the author, she said, the perfect or perfection is the enemy of the good. And I know that I'm too much of a perfectionist. I'm distressed that I found a very few typos in the book. I hope that it is doing well enough that there will be another edition and I can get rid of those typos. But I'm also trying to be a grown-up enough to remember that this is good, even if it isn't perfect, and to know that that's a step, in a way, a very important step for me, to accept that getting it out there, and also discovering that, as I suspected, it is valuable to other people. I've had people write me and say that they've been through medical traumas and that they appreciate my description of what you deal with in a hospital protocols, I had a friend who read it in an earlier version call me when his partner was in the hospital and they did not know what was wrong with her and they were not talking with him and he needed advice from me. And having written this, I felt as if I can give him good advice. And a day later, he wrote me back and said, I did everything you said. Thank you. It's working much better. And this made a difference.
Do you hope to connect more with people who are going through the medical system or who have gone through those kinds of experiences?
I would like to. I don't know the best way to get in touch with those people. I tried one avenue and was told that they did not do any promotions of works, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not so much promoting the work as wanting to be helpful, and in a sense, it's not the kind of book that a brain injury association is going to gobble up because they are more into prescriptive books, if you look at their websites, rather than what someone else said about my book, which is that it's descriptive rather than prescriptive. Right. If you read it and it describes things, then you may have your own ideas as to what you might do in your own life to make things work better. But I am starting to try to find those connections.
Elise Rosenhaupt is author of the book Climbing Back, A Family's Journey Through Brain Injury. She will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore next week, Wednesday, September 9th at 6 in the evening. And that is probably an opportunity for people to not only hear you read from the book, but to talk and maybe to share some of their own experiences.
Absolutely. And I should also mention that our former mayor, David Koss, has agreed to introduce me. And if there are not questions, he and I will have a conversation, but I rather suspect that there will be a lot of questions. I would also like to mention that I am very happy that Dr. Joseph Ratner, who was the chief psychiatrist and still is the chief psychiatrist at New England Rehabilitation Hospital, wrote a wonderful foreword for my book, and I'm so happy that he did that and so grateful to him for that.
It's a wonderful book, Climbing Back, A Family's Journey Through Brain Injury. Elise Rosenhaupt, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.